Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Okay, so imagine a world where your vision just slowly fades, or maybe you've never known clear sight at all.
Mm-hmm.
For millions, this is the reality of inherited retinal diseases, or IRDs.
Mm-hmm.
And these aren't just any genetic conditions. They're incredibly complex, possibly the highest genetic diversity of all human genetic diseases.
That's right. The sheer variety is astounding.
But here's the profound challenge. Trying to pinpoint the exact genetic cause. It could be like, well, finding that single needle in a haystack.
A very large haystack.
Exactly. Hundreds of genes, each with its own subtle variations. And this complexity, it really hinders accurate diagnosis. It slows down the search for effective treatment.
Yeah.
It's a monumental challenge, understanding and tackling these conditions.
So what if there was something, a resource, that could fundamentally shift how we approach this, how we diagnose, how we treat these devastating diseases? Today, we're diving into some really groundbreaking work. It's presented in the paper Retigene, a comprehensive gene atlas for inherited retinal diseases. This is by Carlo Rivolta, Eliphaz Selik, Treda Kamdar, and a really extensive team, over 20 researchers collaborating,
mm-hmm.
published in the American Journal of Human Genetics back in 2025.
Yes, and what truly sets this work apart, I think, isn't just the sheer volume of data. It's the meticulous, expert-driven curation behind it that ensures its reliability. It's a resource the field has, desperately needed to cut through all that complexity of IRDs.
That detailed picture really highlights the complexity, doesn't it? And the urgent need for clarity. So, for those of us maybe less familiar, could you sort of set the stage? What are inherited retinal diseases, fundamentally? And why are they such a unique puzzle for, clinicians and geneticists?
Absolutely. So, inherited retinal diseases, they're a really diverse group of conditions. They're rare, typically Mendelian, meaning they follow distinct patterns of inheritance, from parents to children. And they cause visual impairment, which can be either stationary, so stable, or progressive, meaning it gets worse over time.
Okay.
The retina itself, it's this incredible photosensitive tissue right at the back of your eye. Its job is crucial. Converting light into the electrical signals your brain then uses to form images.
Right.
And it relies on specialized cells. You've got rods for low light vision, cones for sharp central and color vision, and also the retinal pigment epithelium, the RPE. This layer supports the photoreceptors. It absorbs light, transports nutrients, cleans up cellular debris. Really vital housekeeping.
So what goes wrong in IRDs?
Well, the problem is, in IRDs, these vital cells, the photoreceptors, RPE cells, sometimes other retinal neurons, they progressively degenerate, or they just malfunction. And this often leads to severe vision loss or even blindness. What makes them so incredibly challenging is their extreme genetic heterogeneity.
Heterogeneity?
Yeah.
Meaning lots of different genetic causes.
Exactly. Many different genes can cause very similar symptoms, and they can follow various inheritance patterns too, autosomal dominant, autosomal recessive, X-linked, even mitochondrial.
Those sound like distinct pathways for how traits get passed down. Could you maybe quickly break down why knowing these patterns, like dominant versus recessive, is so fundamental for understanding an IRD and maybe for genetic counseling?
Oh, absolutely. It's critical. For instance, in an autosomal dominant condition, just one copy of a faulty gene is enough to cause the disease. So you often see it in every generation of a family.
Okay.
With recessive, you need two faulty copies. One from each parent. This means carriers, people with just one copy, might show no symptoms at all, but they can still pass the faulty gene on.
Yeah.
And then X-linked conditions involve genes on the X chromosome, so they impact males and females differently. Knowing this distinction is really crucial for predicting how the disease might progress, for family planning, and for identifying other relatives who might be at risk.
So it's not just one gene going wrong.
Yeah.
It's a whole universe of possibilities.
Yeah.
And how it's inherited changes everything. We're talking about conditions like retinitis pigmentosa, RP. That affects rods first, so night vision goes.
That's a classic example, yes.
Or Leber congenital amaurosis, LCA, which can cause blindness right from infancy.
Mm-hmm. Very severe. Often.
And if the eye wasn't complex enough, these diseases can also be syndromic, meaning they affect other organs too.
Precisely, like in Usher syndrome, which famously impacts hearing as well as vision.
Wow, okay.
And despite all the advances we've made in gene discovery over the years, we've faced this really significant diagnostic gap. Current genetic testing, even with powerful techniques like next-generation sequencing or NGS.
Which lets you read millions of DNA bits at once, right?
Exactly. Even with NGS, the diagnostic rate only hits somewhere between, say, 53% and 76%.
That still leaves a big chunk of people without answers.
It does. And this gap isn't just about technical limitations, though those play a part. A major hurdle has simply been the absence of a standardized, comprehensive, and crucially up-to-date catalog of all the genes known to be associated with these diseases. Without that reliable list, interpreting the vast number of genetic variants we find, it's incredibly difficult. Designing accurate genetic tests becomes a real challenge.
Well, okay, given those immense challenges, that persistent diagnostic gap, what was the main driving force, the mission maybe, that brought this huge team together to create Retigene?
The mission was crystal clear. Create that essential roadmap, that definitive, thoroughly validated catalog for inherited retinal diseases. So to tackle this, the researchers developed Retigene, this expert-curated gene atlas. Their core method involved, well, extensive data mining, pulling information from public databases, combing through published literature to identify every gene ever linked to IRDs. But what's really crucial here, the key step, was that each potential gene was individually curated by at least two independent experts.
Two experts for each gene.
Yes, ensuring really rigorous validation.
Wow, that sounds like an immense effort. Just the coordination, the deep expertise needed every single step. Were there specific challenges or maybe surprising hurdles they encountered in ensuring that rigorous human-guided validation for, what, hundreds of genes?
Oh, it truly is an immense undertaking. And yes, challenges definitely arise. Beyond just identifying the genes, they integrated all sorts of diverse data sources. You have the genetic variant data itself, then bulk RNA sequencing from the Phantom 5 dataset.
Which gives you a map of gene expression across lots of tissues.
Exactly, a really broad view. And then they even brought in single-cell RNA sequencing, Seqi RNA-Seq, that lets you zoom right in and see gene activity within specific types of retinal cells. Super detailed.
Yeah.
On top of all that, they incorporated functional annotations using gene ontology or TRUGO terms.
That's like a standardized dictionary for what genes do.
Precisely. It helps understand the biological roles these genes are playing. And the challenge often lies in, well, reconciling conflicting data from different sources. Or maybe the evidence for one gene is suggestive, but not quite definitive. You need to make sure all the available evidence really points strongly towards disease causation before including it.
So it's like building this layered, almost interactive map, bringing together all these different perspectives on each gene's role, its expression.
Yeah, yeah.
With all that data, how did they actually decide which genes made the final cut?
For this definitive atlas, they had very strict inclusion criteria, really rigorous. Ultimately, 470 genes made it onto the main list, plus four specific genetic locations or loci RP17, MCDR1, MCDR3, XQ27.1. These were retained based on strong, you know, unequivocal evidence linking them to disease.
470 genes, that's a lot.
It is. And they also flagged another 196 genes as candidates.
Candidates meaning?
Meaning the evidence was maybe from just a single affected family. So suggestive, but more research is needed to really confirm their role.
Okay, so potential future additions.
Exactly. And just as importantly, they systematically excluded 17 genes.
Excluded? Why?
Because the evidence was insufficient, or it was conflicting, or in some cases it was definitively disproven. Maybe newer studies contradicted earlier findings. This rigorous, almost surgical approach deciding what not to include is absolutely key to creating a truly reliable resource. It prevents those false positives that can really mislead diagnostics and send research down the wrong path.
Right, that makes sense. So with this incredibly comprehensive and meticulously built atlas, what were some of the most striking patterns or maybe unexpected findings that emerged from Retigene's data about this whole IRD landscape?
Well, the atlas certainly confirmed the vast genetic landscape. Those 470 strongly associated genes really paint a picture. They found that 206 of these genes were linked specifically to non-syndromic diseases, so affecting only the eye. Another 323 were linked to syndromic forms, affecting multiple body systems.
Okay.
But what's really interesting is that 59 genes, they actually contribute to both categories. There's an overlap.
An overlap. 59 genes causing both eye-only and multi-system problems.
Mm-hmm.
That overlap isn't just a fascinating statistic, is it? I mean, what does that actually tell us about the underlying biology And maybe more importantly, how might that finding impact how we classify these conditions or even think about treatment strategies?
That's a really crucial point. This overlap strongly suggests that for some genes, the outcome really depends on the specific mutation, or maybe other genetic factors, modifiers are at play. So the same gene, depending on the context, can manifest differently, sometimes just in the eye, sometimes hitting multiple systems.
Mm.
It definitely pushes us to think beyond rigid classifications. We need a more nuanced approach to diagnosis, and maybe even for potential gene therapies. You know, targeting one gene might have broader implications than we initially thought.
That's a really important consideration. Okay, what about the inheritance patterns? Across this diverse set of 470 genes, did any particular pattern stand out?
Yes, definitely. The majority of these IRD-associated genes, almost 69% or 324 genes, showed an autosomal recessive inheritance pattern.
So needing two faulty copies is the most common scenario.
By far. Then came autosomal dominant, that was about 15%. Then a category called ADAR, where a gene can cause dominant or recessive disease depending on the mutation, that was nearly 8%. Then X-linked at about 4.7% and mitochondrial inheritance at 3.6%. Those were less common.
Okay.
But what's also striking is that many genes, 52 of them, which is about a quarter of the non-syndromic ones, were associated with more than one clinical phenotype, more than one type of eye disease.
One gene, multiple conditions.
Exactly. For instance, genes like CRX, CRB1, and PRPH2. Each of those was linked to four different non-syndromic conditions, ranging from retinitis pigmentosa all the way to Leber congenital amaurosis.
Wow. That really highlights the incredible complexity. One gene, multiple ways it can manifest. And you mentioned earlier how the type of genetic change can matter significantly in these varied presentations.
Yes, exactly. That came through really clearly in the data. They found the specific variant matters greatly. Take CRB1 again. Typically, loss of function variants mutations that basically break the gene completely, those tend to cause the severe condition, LCA. But missense variants in CRB1 ones that just change a single amino acid building block in the protein they might lead to RP, or perhaps different types of macular dystrophies, MDs, often less severe. Similarly, variations in the GUCY2D gene show different effects depending on their type and location within the gene. It really speaks to these intricate genotype-phenotype correlations that are at play.
So it's not just where the mutation is, but what kind of mutation it is. Could you maybe clarify that difference a bit more between loss of function and missense, and why one might lead to something really severe like LCA, while another causes RP?
Absolutely. It's a fundamental concept. A loss of function variant, often called low F, usually means the gene simply can't make its protein product at all. Or the protein it makes is completely non-functional, totally useless.
Like a key part just missing from a machine.
Exactly. It's like a critical component is entirely removed. And that typically leads to more severe conditions because that function is just gone.
Okay. Makes sense.
A missense variant, on the other hand, changes just one single amino acid, one building block in the protein chain. This might only subtly alter the protein's shape or function. Think of it like a slightly ill-fitting part in that machine.
Still works. Maybe, but not perfectly.
Right. Or maybe it works differently. And this can cause different symptoms, sometimes milder ones, depending on precisely where that changes and how critical that part of the protein's function is.
Ah, okay.
And this nuance is absolutely key to understanding these genotype-phenotype correlations. For example, for genes involved in cilia, these tiny cellular structures like ARL3, CEP290, or USH2A, severe loss of function variants in those genes tend to cause the syndromic forms affecting multiple systems, whereas milder changes like certain missense variants or splicing variants that affect how the gene's message is processed, those are more often associated with non-syndromic disease, just affecting the eye.
So understanding how the gene is broken is as important as knowing which gene is broken.
Precisely. It's a critical insight for clinicians. It means understanding not just which gene is affected, but how it's affected becomes paramount for giving an accurate prognosis, for predicting the disease course, and of course, for guiding potential gene-specific therapies down the line. It makes the whole diagnostic process far more precise.
That level of specificity is incredible. But as you mentioned, this level of detail wasn't always possible, was it? Looking back, How has the actual process of discovering these genes evolved over time? What does that history tell us about where we are now in IRD research?
Oh, it's quite a story, really. The very first IRD gene identified was OAT way back in 1988. For years after that, gene discovery was, well, a steady trickle, maybe about 11 genes identified each year. This was primarily done through linkage analysis.
Which is like tracking disease inheritance alongside known genetic markers in families.
Exactly. Painstaking work, often requiring large families. Then, around 2010, next-generation sequencing, NGS, just changed everything, completely revolutionized the field.
The game changer you mentioned earlier.
The game changer. The discovery rate surged. It peaked around 2018, hitting about 26 new genes identified per year then. FAM-161A was actually the first IRD gene identified specifically using NGS methods.
Wow, quite a peak.
But interestingly, after 2018, the pace slowed down again. Quite significantly. Down to about 8 genes a year recently, and only 6 identified in 2024, according to this paper.
Why the slowdown?
It really speaks to the scientific landscape. I think the general consensus is that the low-hanging fruit have largely been picked.
Meaning the more common or easier to find genes.
Exactly. For those of us in the field, it presents a new kind of challenge. It's becoming less about the sheer volume of brand new discoveries and more about refining our understanding of the genes we know and tackling the incredibly rare or complex cases that remain unexplained. This slowdown is likely because the remaining undiscovered genes are probably increasingly rare in the population, or they contribute to only a very small fraction of affected individuals. Finding them requires different strategies, often larger collaborative efforts.
So the easily identifiable genes are mostly found, and now the hunt is on for the more obscure ones. Connecting that point back to the Retigene Atlas, what did the functional analysis tell us about what these 470 genes actually do within our biology? What roles do they play?
Yeah, looking at the gene functions was really revealing. The largest functional category, perhaps not surprisingly, was related to the cilium. That category comprised 83 genes, nearly 18% of the total.
Cilia. Those are the tiny hair-like structures on cells.
That's right. And they play an absolutely critical role in photoreceptor physiology. They're involved in sensing light, transporting proteins, maintaining the cell structure. So it makes sense that defects there would cause major problems.
Okay. What else stood out?
Transmembrane transport was another big one, involving 69 genes moving things across cell membranes. And lipid metabolism, dealing with fats, that was also highly represented with 62 genes. Interestingly, the genes directly involved in the visual cycle and phototransduction, the core processes of converting light to a signal.
The stuff you might expect to be number one.
Right. That category, VCPH, actually came in 10th, with only 32 genes.
Huh. Why is that?
Well, it probably reflects a historical shift in research focus. Decades ago, research was heavily focused on those core retina-specific pathways. But with newer, unbiased methods like NGS, researchers started finding disease genes involved in more fundamental, widespread cellular processes like cilia function or transport or metabolism that, when disrupted, happened to severely impact the highly sensitive and specialized cells of the retina.
So it broadened the scope beyond just the eye-specific machinery.
Precisely. It revealed how reliant the retina is on these fundamental cellular processes working correctly.
And how did these functions connect with that distinction you made earlier between the syndromic diseases affecting multiple systems and the non-syndromic ones just affecting the eye? Were there clear functional differences there too?
Yes, there were quite distinct patterns that emerged when they broke it down that way. For the non-syndromic IRDs, the ones just affecting the eye, genes that are highly expressed specifically in photoreceptors, or the RPE, were very prevalent, about 47.6%, so nearly half of the genes linked only to non-syndromic IRDs were classified as retina prevalent.
Meaning they're much more active in the retina than elsewhere.
Exactly. Their expression is significantly higher there compared to other tissues. Makes intuitive sense.
But only about half. What about the others?
Well, this is fascinating. A really significant portion, 40.1% or 59 genes causing non-syndromic IRDs, were actually ubiquitously expressed.
Meaning they're active pretty much everywhere in the body.
Yes. Common housekeeping genes, you could call them. And this finding really supports a key hypothesis in the field, that the retina, because of its high metabolic demands and unique structure, is uniquely sensitive. It can be vulnerable to even minor disturbances in these general fundamental cellular functions provided by housekeeping genes.
So even a gene doing a basic job everywhere can cause an eye-specific disease if it's slightly off.
That seems to be the case for many non-syndromic IRDs, yes.
Okay. And what about the syndromic IRDs, the ones affecting multiple systems?
For those, the picture was very different, as you might expect. Nearly 85%, 224 genes associated with syndromic forms were classified as not retina prevalent.
So broadly expressed across many tissues.
Exactly. Reflecting their involvement in these multi-system conditions, often things like ciliopathies disorders affecting cilia function, which is vital in many different organs, not just the eye.
Right.
And the single-cell RNA sequencing data, that really fine-grained expression data, added another layer. It showed that genes linked to retinitis pigmentosa, for instance, were often expressed highly in photoreceptors and RPE cells, matching what we see clinically. But for syndromic conditions like Usher syndrome, specific Usher genes like USH1G, CLRN, CDH23, they were even found to be expressed in Müller glial cells.
Müller cells, those are support cells in the retina, right? Not the photoreceptors themselves.
Right.
Correct. They're critical support cells. Finding Usher genes expressed there highlights the complex roles these genes play, potentially affecting multiple cell types within the retina and, of course, other parts of the body like the ear. It goes beyond just the photoreceptors.
That is an incredible level of detail. It really feels like a true deep dive into the genetic and cellular landscape, which brings us, I think, to the crucial question. How does retigene really stand out from other resources that might already exist? And ultimately, what does this all mean for patients and for the future of IRD research?
Right, that's a really important question. How does retigene distinguish itself? I think one of its absolute key strengths is active refinement and that rigorous expert curation we talked about.
Human element.
The human element, exactly. Compared to some other databases, retigene actually includes a greater number of IRD-associated genes overall, particularly many linked to those syndromic forms. But crucially, it applies much stricter inclusion criteria. And this rigorous process allows them not just to add genes, but also to systematically exclude genes where there's strong contradictory evidence. This is vital for preventing misdiagnoses, which can have just profound impacts on patients' lives and treatment paths.
Can you give an example? Like a concrete illustration of a gene that retigene's strict criteria led them to discard, even if it's maybe still used elsewhere.
Yeah, a perfect example they discuss is the gene UNC119.
UNC119.
Yes. Now, this gene is actually still present on many clinical IRD gene panels that labs use routinely today.
Really?
Yes. But retigene, through its very rigorous curation process, has classified UNC119 as discarded.
Discarded. Why? What was the evidence against it?
The evidence was compelling. It included things like the surprisingly high frequency of variants previously reported as pathogenic actually being found in the general healthy population. That's a big red flag.
Means they probably aren't causing disease if healthy people have them.
Exactly. Also, a lack of co-segregation, meaning the supposed disease-causing variant didn't consistently track with the disease in affected families. And finally, evidence showing the gene is actually quite tolerant to truncating variants the type that should break it. If the gene can be broken without causing disease, it's unlikely to be the culprit.
So multiple lines of evidence pointing away from it.
Right. And providing this clear signal to diagnostic laboratories is absolutely critical. It helps prevent misinterpretations based on outdated or weaker evidence and ensures more accurate diagnoses moving forward.
That's a really powerful example. It sounds like retigene isn't just about adding genes, but it also requires the maybe scientific courage to remove them when the evidence points decisively elsewhere. What does that process of discarding a gene feel like for researchers who might have spent years studying it, thinking it was involved?
Oh, it can certainly be challenging personally and professionally, but ultimately it's a testament to scientific integrity, isn't it? When new, stronger evidence emerges, the scientific community has to adapt. We have to be willing to revise our understanding, and this commitment to accuracy, even when it means reevaluating long-held assumptions or published work, that's what ultimately moves the field forward. And most importantly, it's what benefits patients in the long run.
Yeah.
So ultimately, retigene serves multiple purposes. It supports researchers in prioritizing which candidate genes to study next. It aids functional studies trying to understand how these genes work, and it's a truly vital tool for therapeutic development, helping target the right genes. This comprehensive and critically continuously updated catalog will definitely help in identifying true disease-causing variants more precisely and in designing better, more accurate genetic testing panels.
You mentioned continuously updated. That idea of a living resource seems really powerful. How does that continuous updating and expert curation translate directly into tangible benefits for patients, for diagnostic labs, maybe even today, beyond just providing a static list?
Well, it's all about precision and efficiency, really. By having this validated dynamic resource, diagnostic labs can build more accurate and targeted gene panels right now. This should help reduce that awful diagnostic odyssey many patients endure, where they go years without a clear genetic answer.
Getting answers faster.
Hopefully, yes. And for researchers, it means they can focus their limited resources, time, funding on investigating genes with the strongest evidence behind them. This should accelerate the pace of new discoveries and ultimately the development of potential therapeutic interventions.
Makes sense.
And crucially, as you noted, it's openly accessible online at retigene.airdc.info. Anyone can use it. This ensures it remains a living, global resource for the entire scientific and clinical community, constantly evolving as new knowledge emerges.
Fantastic. So summing it up then.
Yeah, I think the central insight here is this. Retigene is an expertly curated and dynamically updated gene atlas. It brings unprecedented clarity to the incredibly complex genetic landscape of inherited retinal diseases. By integrating all these diverse data types and applying really rigorous validation, it provides a critical foundation, a foundation for more accurate molecular diagnosis, for more targeted research, and we hope for the faster development of effective therapies.
So, thinking about that impact, what does this mean for finally overcoming that diagnostic odyssey so many patients face? And how might this truly accelerate the journey from discovering a gene to actually developing sight-saving treatments?
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science base by base.